Architecture is one of the areas where Greece and Rome most seamlessly interconnected, and also one where the Roman genius was most transformative of what it inherited. The classical style of Greek architecture reached its apogee in the second half of the 5th century BC, most notably in the buildings that were erected on the Acropolis in Athens, the Propylaea, the monumental gateway, the Erechtheum, the temple of Poseidon Erechtheus, one of the most complex Greek buildings ever constructed, repaired, incidentally, in 27 BC, just after Actium, and, above all, the Parthenon. But the subsequent Hellenistic era saw further important developments, both in the construction of temples and other religious edifices. We've already considered one of the most stunning examples, the great altar at Pergamum, and in the construction of fortifications. Roman architecture, like Roman art, drew its initial inspiration from Etruscan models. Only much later, in the 2nd century BC, did the Romans begin to build in accordance with the precise canons of Greek architecture, though they were familiar with the basics of Greek building techniques long before that. As in so much else, the Augustan period was pivotal. The only surviving treatise on architecture, Vitruvius's De Architectura, was written in the reign of Augustus, and in fact is dedicated to the princeps, though oddly, Vitruvius has little to say about buildings put up in his reign. He drew heavily from treatises written by Greek architects, which are no longer extant. There's a famous quote in Suetonius to the effect that Augustus found Rome in brick and left it in marble. This was particularly true of the centre of Rome. Previously, the most commonly used building material was tufa, a rock formed from volcanic ash. Tufa is easy to work, but inadequate to bearing a heavy load, and it also crumbles when it weathers. As a result of Augustus's preference for marble, a widely diffused marble trade established itself throughout the Mediterranean, and marbles of all colours began arriving in Rome. Other materials were, of course, also used in this period, particularly concrete, which the Romans first employed in the 3rd century BC, but which they applied much more daringly in the imperial period. One of the chief reasons why the Romans adopted concrete is because, unlike the Greeks, they didn't have marble quarries close at hand. What I'm going to do in this lecture is to look at a number of different architectural forms and compare their respective application by the Greeks and the Romans to illustrate both commonality and difference. I'd like to note at the beginning, however, that the Romans didn't just imitate and adapt. They also despoiled Greece of its architectural treasures, as they despoiled it of its art. The Roman generals, Sulla, Crassus, and Lucullus, all brought columns back from the Temple of Olympian Zeus in Athens and displayed them in that of Capitoline Jupiter in Rome. It's also important to note that although we can only rarely attach an architect's name to a building in the ancient world, it's extremely likely that many public buildings in Rome and elsewhere were designed by Greek architects. Writing in 45 BC, Cicero, to his friend Atticus, says, "A compatriot of yours, i.e. an Athenian, is enlarging Rome, which he only saw for the first time 2 years ago, and which he now thinks is too small to hold him, even though in the past it was big enough to hold our master." Master is in quotes here, so to speak, meaning Julius Caesar, who had been assassinated a short while ago. Cicero had a very conflicted relationship with him. Anyway, the point is that Greek architects were working in Rome by the middle of the 1st century BC, and it seems from Cicero's remark, with grand designs. The Emperor Trajan, writing to Pliny, governor of Bithynia over a century and a half later, says much the same thing. Don't bother to wait for an architect to be sent you from Rome to your province. They usually come from Greece, even to Rome. I'll begin with the temple, which remained throughout the pagan world the most important building type. The basis of all temple architecture was a stepped platform on which stood an oblong sanctum or sacred area. There was a porch at one end or both ends and sometimes a surrounding colonnade. The columns supported an entablature that was crowned with a pediment at the short ends, on either side of which was a raked roof. There were originally two orders of Greek architecture, conventionally referred to as Doric and Ionic. Very broadly speaking, Doric was favoured in the classical period, Ionic more in the Hellenistic period. A third order was Corinthian, which became very popular in Roman times. As we noted before, Corinthian is a misnomer. Paradoxically, it was the Doric order that was invented in Corinth. The Romans also added two orders of their own, the Tuscan order, a kind of simplified, stripped-down Doric, and the composite order, which combined Ionic and Corinthian features. The first major temple to be constructed in Rome was dedicated to Jupiter Optimus Maximus, greatest and best, and his companion deities Juno and Minerva on the Capitoline Hill. It dates to the late 5th or early 4th century, and it looked very like a Greek temple. Whether the Romans copied the Etruscans, who had themselves copied the Greeks, or whether they copied Greek architects directly, a Greek-style temple now stood on the summit of Rome's most sacred spot. I say Greek-style because, in fact, it wasn't to the precise canons of Greek architecture. Despite the obvious similarities, however, the Romans conceived of temples very differently from the Greeks, and these differences tell us a great deal about the differing functions of a temple in both societies. First, a Greek temple can be approached up the steps from any side, and often the best view is from a corner, and that is how many approaches to temples are arranged. A Roman temple, by contrast, looks its best from the front and can be entered only from the front. Secondly, a Roman temple stands on a much higher podium than its Greek equivalent. Consider, for instance, the Maison Carrée at Nîmes in southern France, built in 16 BC, one of the best-preserved Roman temples, and compare it with the Parthenon. The Maison Carrée is far more elevated. One explanation for the extra height is that the Romans wanted to emphasize the separation between the priesthood and the people. Another is that Roman temples had a secular as well as a religious role. They were designed to convey a sense of pomp and circumstance that was alien to the spirit of a Greek temple. Meetings of the Senate, for instance, were sometimes held inside, or speeches to the public might be delivered al fresco from the podium. Though Roman architecture preserved the architectural conventions invented by the Greeks, it also developed them in completely new ways, notably after the introduction of concrete, that's to say, mortared rubble. Concrete is much stronger than ashlar, a masonry that is made out of blocks of hewn stone, and can be used to span much wider areas. It thus allows much bigger floor space and reduces the likelihood of fires. The Greeks had largely limited themselves to the post and lintel system, which permits only a narrow interval between the uprights. With concrete, the Romans were able to span very much larger areas by the use of the arch, the vault, and the dome. The vault and the dome had already been employed by the Mycenaeans in the 13th century BC, but there'd been a break in the architectural tradition. The Greeks first used the vault in the 5th century BC, but did not regard it as aesthetically satisfying, and only employed it where it wasn't conspicuous, as in the subterranean tomb chambers of Macedonian nobles and kings. The Romans had no such inhibitions. A good early example of concrete vaulted architecture is the Porticus Aemilia on the banks of the Tiber in Rome, about 193 BC. It was the arch that enabled the Romans to build bridges, aqueducts, viaducts, and sewers, all essential to the running of the empire. Even modest-sized towns had aqueducts. One of the best preserved is the Pont du Gard at Nîmes, built between 20 to 16 BC. Same place where the temple is, I mentioned a moment ago. The water was brought from over 30 miles away, and it's been calculated that over that entire distance, it ran down a slope at a ratio of 1 to 3,000. In other words, the water had dropped only 55 feet over 30 miles. Rome itself had 11 aqueducts built at intervals in her history to keep pace with her growth. The supreme example of the use of the vault is the basilica, which, in a sense, became the signature of Roman architecture in the imperial period. This was a rectangular hall divided into one or more naves and aisles by interior colonnades. We don't know for certain whether the Romans invented the basilica. The word is Greek. It's shorthand for basiliki stoa, meaning royal hall. And it may be that the name derived from a famous hall built by a Hellenistic king, but if so, we have no record of it. Basilicas were commonly added on one or more sides of a forum. Some had as many as four internal colonnades. One of the most impressive examples is the Basilica Julia on the southern side of the forum. It's so named because it was begun by Julius Caesar in 54 BC, though it was only completed by Augustus. It's over 100 metres long and nearly 50 metres wide. I was talking to Albert Ammerman recently, an archaeologist, and he told me that it actually floats because the surface on which it lies is essentially gravel. And what the Romans did was to sink large poles beneath the gravel in order to support it. It's one of the most remarkable buildings in classical antiquity. The basilica later played an important role in church architecture from the reign of Constantine onwards, notably in Rome itself, where Constantine gave funds to the bishop to construct churches. In contrast to the vault, by which I mean a ceiling, formed out of a half cylinder, the dome, by which I mean a half sphere, was an entirely Roman invention. The most spectacular use of the dome is in the Pantheon, which was constructed in Rome in the reign of, and perhaps under the watchful eye of, the Emperor Hadrian, 117 to 38 were the dates of his reign. The Pantheon, the word which is Greek means all the gods, is an extraordinary building too. When you approach it from the front, it looks like a conventional Greek-style temple. A low podium leads to a porch that is entered through Corinthian columns. The only oddity is the height of the pediment in relation to its width. Most pediments are much lower. The height is to conceal the circular building to the rear, a whopping 43 metres in diameter. And above the circular space is a dome, also 43 metres high. The only source of light comes from an oculus or eye, 9 metres in diameter, set in the ceiling. To carry the weight of the dome, which is entirely self-supporting, the building materials become progressively lighter. The lower sections are made of stone, the middle sections of brick, and the top section of concrete. The whole building is a masterpiece of Roman engineering. And at the same time, it represents a perfect blend between traditional Greek architectural forms and Roman inventiveness. And it presents us with something entirely new in the history of architecture, a vast, uncluttered interior space, which, in the words of Frank Sear, creates the physical embodiment of the universal cosmos. Sadly, we don't know the name of the architect, and in general, few names can be attached to even the most important Roman buildings, which suggests that architects did not enjoy high status in the Roman world. The design of the Pantheon has been copied repeatedly, notably in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and in most other state capitol buildings all over the U.S. The Romans used architecture in a manner and on a scale that was foreign to the Greeks in a number of ways. First, whereas the classical and Hellenistic Greek state, by and large, did not see it as one of its principal functions to provide basic amenities for the public, the Romans emphatically did. Second, the Romans placed much more emphasis upon secular and utilitarian buildings than the Greeks, who devoted most of their resources and ingenuity towards the construction of temples. And third, the Romans used architecture to serve the needs of, and often to accommodate inside, vast numbers of people. Now, the chief exception to this rule was aqueducts, which the Greeks did regard as essential. One of the most striking examples is a rock-hewn tunnel, 3/4 of a mile in length, that was cut into a hill on the island of Samos. It's dated to the 6th century BC. Let's keep with this third point. Most of the largest architectural structures in the Greek world were theatres, some of which could hold 20 to 40,000 people, depending on whether you counted the people who sat on the grassy slopes above the level where there was permanent seating. That's peanuts compared with what the Romans built. The Circus Maximus, where chariot races took place, could hold about 250,000. Moreover, the Romans sought to accommodate vast numbers of people within the interior of the building. They had a totally different concept of size and number from the Greeks. And all this was reflected in the type of buildings that the Romans put up, crowd containers, as Lewis Mumford has described them. One of the building types that reflects this need was the public baths, which became a common feature of every well-appointed Roman town. Though modest-sized public bathhouses existed in Greece from the 4th century BC onwards, they were not regarded as an essential public facility, which is what they became in the Roman world. Roman baths, in a way, symbolize Roman civilization. The first such structure in Rome was the baths of Agrippa, which he bequeathed to the people of Rome on his death in 12 BC. Subsequently, baths were regarded as a fit object for imperial munificence. The Emperor Trajan, early 2nd century, Caracalla, early 3rd century, and Diocletian, early 4th century, all provided the capital with baths at their own expense. They were the largest buildings in Rome, and they could accommodate thousands of bathers at one time. Equally symbolic of Roman civilization is the amphitheatre. As the name suggests, an amphitheatre looked like two theatres placed back to back with the intervening stage area removed. The earliest purpose-built amphitheatre is the one at Pompeii, dated after 80 BC. The largest amphitheatre, and arguably the greatest surviving feat of Roman engineering, is the Colosseum in Rome, dedicated in the reign of the Emperor Titus, 79 to 81, with a seating capacity of 50,000. The use to which such buildings was put, however, brutal gladiatorial contests, bloody contests with wild beasts and savage and sometimes protracted executions, reflected the Roman taste for spectacle. In stark contrast, one might note, to the Greek penchant for dramatic poetry. It's sometimes argued that the purpose of such spectacles was to relieve social tensions within the citizen body at large, though there are instances when they actually increased those tensions, which then erupted into violence. There was, however, one important area in which Greek theatres and Roman amphitheatres did resemble one another. In both cases, seating was allocated in a manner that reflected divisions within the citizen body. In the case of the Theatre of Dionysus in Athens, for instance, the seating was divided into wedges, each wedge being reserved for the members of one of the 10 Athenian tribes, while the front rows were reserved for priests, visiting dignitaries, and the like. So too, in the case of Roman amphitheatres, and indeed Roman theatres as well, the allocation of the seating was a reflection of the class structure of Roman society, with senators occupying the front rows and the riffraff, the upper tiers. Another architectural innovation that illustrates how the Romans were required to think in terms of large numbers is the apartment block, or insula, literally island, so named because insulae frequently took up a whole city block and were ringed around by roads or streets. Insulae, some of which were as many as 10 stories in height, were built out of concrete and baked brick in a style known as opus testaceum. The earliest insulae may have been constructed as early as the late 2nd century BC, and they're testimony to the increase in Rome's population that occurred at that time. Insulae were still being built in the 7th century AD. It goes without saying that very many more people dwelt in apartment blocks than did in private houses. A document compiled in the 4th century AD, known as the Regionary Catalogue, records that there were 46,602 insulae in Rome, compared with only 1,797 private houses. Insulae were at high risk from both fire and earth tremors. The satirical poet Juvenal movingly describes the plight of a tenant of an insula caught in a fire. He writes, "Ucalegon, one of the tenants, is already shouting for water and moving his belongings. Smoke is pouring out of your third floor attic, but you don't realize it. For if the alarm goes off on the ground floor, the last person to be burnt alive will be the man who has nothing to shelter him from the rain but the tiles." Juvenal's point is that the cheapest accommodation was on the top floor. Augustus limited the height of insulae to 70 feet and Trajan reduced their height to 60 feet, but there were no doubt many exceptions and many violations and therefore many disasters and many deaths. Finally, private houses. This too is an area where there was very considerable overlap, though we know much less about Greek domestic architecture than Roman. This is partly due to the fact that the chief building material was unbaked mud brick, which rarely survives. What does survive are the stone socles or bases which supported the mud brick walls. One of the most important sites for the study of Greek domestic architecture is Olynthos in Chalkidiki, where the ground plans of a number of houses are preserved. They show a great deal of variety in scale and lavishness. Some consist of just two rooms, others of seven, and most with an interior south-facing courtyard. Interior decorating was quite simple. The walls were covered with plaster overlaid with a wash. The floors consisted of beaten earth with clay on top. Though we hear of two stories, there is no archaeological evidence for this fact. There's also relatively little evidence for the strict separation of men's and women's quarters of the house, which we occasionally read of in literary accounts. Rather, it seems that the rooms fulfilled a variety of functions and that the separation would only be observed, therefore, on an occasional basis. The arrangements of Roman domestic architecture were very different. To begin with, there is no evidence in either the literary or the archaeological record for the segregation of the sexes. In fact, Roman houses were largely open plan. Men, women, children, and slaves intermingled and moved around freely. Typically, a domus was shielded from the noise and grime of the street by shops that fronted it. The plan consisted of an entrance known as fauces, jaws, highly imaginative that I always think, since there would have probably have been a dog to ward off unwanted visitors, leading to a central rectangular area known as the atrium, with an entry in the roof to let in light and air, and a basin underneath to collect rainwater. Directly facing the fauces was the tablinum, an office where the master of the house conducted business. All the other rooms led off from the atrium. When the Romans encountered the Greeks, they added a more private area at the back of the house known as a peristyle, a word taken from the Greek meaning a row of columns surrounding a court, with other rooms leading off from it. The court in question would often be a garden. Whereas the majority of Greek houses were modest in scale and appointment, many Roman houses and villas were extremely lavish and luxurious. In fact, whereas the Greeks spent a great deal on great public works while residing in modest dwellings, the Romans invested equally in public and private architecture. As we saw earlier, Roman houses were frequently decorated with mosaics and wall paintings, and Roman houses became more and more lavish over time. Pliny the Elder tells us that what was regarded as the best house in Rome in 78 BC was very modest by the standards of the next generation. The most spectacular Roman house of all time was the Domus Aurea, or Golden House, which Nero erected in the center of Rome, covering an area of 125 acres. The Domus Aurea, some of which is still preserved, employed concrete vaulting in a totally unprecedented way. By the first century BC, it was becoming common for wealthy Romans to own a villa outside Rome, a place to retire to, away from the bustle of the city, in the country or on the coast. One of the most lavish country villas is the one which Hadrian constructed at Tivoli, 15 miles from Rome between AD 125 and 138. Its grounds were inspired by his extensive travels in the East. Also spectacular is the villa at Piazza Armerina in central southern Sicily, which dates to the early 4th century AD. Scholars believe that the owner was probably a wealthy Roman senator. Some 45 rooms have so far come to light. And some 40 of these rooms are decorated with polychrome mosaics depicting scenes from mythology, as well as scenes of hunting and fishing and chariot racing. Despite the considerable debt to Greek architecture, the type of buildings that came to characterize the Roman city, its aqueducts, baths, basilicas, circuses, houses, villas, and so forth, it was these that were the most distinctive, even though the architectural styles upon which they were based largely derived from Greek models. And these building types were exported to the Greek-speaking East, as they were to other parts of the empire. Only the amphitheatre failed to make the same inroads in the East, seemingly because of a revulsion towards the atrocities that took place inside it. Apart from the imperial baths, the last great building put up in Rome was the Pantheon. Henceforth, the Mediterranean basin moves to centre stage, and it is to this larger orbit that I now want to turn. From the 2nd century onwards, cities all around the Mediterranean were competing with the capital for imperial patronage. A prime example is Lepcis Magna, the birth city of the emperor Septimius Severus, who reigned from 193 to 211 in the Roman province of Tripolitania in North Africa. Severus built a new forum, a basilica, a nympheum or monumental fountain house, and a colonnaded street over 50 metres broad, all conceived as an integrated whole. Another example of the same tendency is Augusta Treverorum, the august city of the Treveri. The Treveri were a German tribe, modern Trier on the banks of the Moselle, possibly the oldest city in Germany. When Constantine chose Constantinople as the imperial capital, Augusta Treverorum became second only to Rome in importance in the West. Its importance was due to its strategic location on Rome's northern border. The most successful Mediterranean city in attracting imperial patronage was, in fact, Constantinople, which I'll be talking about in some detail later. Another important development is the emergence of a style of architecture which, though Greco-Roman, took on the features of the local culture, and which served local, primarily religious needs. We see this at Palmyra, an oasis town in central Syria, situated on the caravan route to India, China, and Arabia. Palmyra became extremely important after AD 137, when the Roman authorities began to levy duties on goods entering the town. The architecture that subsequently graced the city was an amalgam of Greek, Roman, Semitic and Parthian elements. One of the most striking buildings is the Temple of Bel. Bel is another form of Baal, whom we meet in the Hebrew Bible. It's a Hellenistic-style Greek temple built under Roman rule and adapted to the needs of a Semitic cult. We see a similar phenomenon at Dura Europus, a city on the Euphrates, where there is the oldest preserved synagogue in the Mediterranean, as well as the oldest identifiable church. Originally a Babylonian foundation, Dura Europus was refounded by the Seleucid dynasty in 300 BC and then captured by the Parthians about 200 years later. In AD 165, it came into the possession of the Romans, who converted it into a garrison town on their eastern frontier. A third example is a temple to a Syrian thunder god identified with Jupiter Heliopolitanus, which was completed around the middle of the 3rd century AD at Baalbek, a town in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. The temple, a very Greek-looking, was one of the grandest structures in the entire Roman Empire. To conclude, it was through architecture that the Mediterranean achieved a visible cultural uniformity, one that reflected in so many ways its Greco-Roman roots. That uniformity was based on an unwavering adherence to the orders of architecture which had been established by the Greeks and modified and extended by the Romans. In the next lecture, we're going to discuss science and technology. As we'll see, though the Romans themselves lacked an aptitude for scientific discovery, they were not only attuned to its practical benefits, but also provided a supportive environment in which Greek scientists could continue to make significant advances.